last week. Is the tape on? Okay. We left off last week with a question that was raised about from Rashi's point of view, that a ben Noach is not permitted to take off a full day and not work, refrain from work for a full day. Now, I mentioned to you that that's Rashi's opinion, only Rashi's opinion. The Rambam, Maimonides, doesn't learn that way, neither do most others. So, therefore, I said that ben Noach is not obligated, really, to... strictly speaking, is not obligated to abide by Rashi's decision. Nevertheless, it is Rashi's decision is something which should be reckoned with, should be understood, and also it should be followed if possible. If a person wishes to follow Rashi, they certainly are considered virtuous, because it is in fact a position, and there is no real halachic decision making after the time of the close of the Talmud. So the question was, according to Rashi, is a ben Noach permitted? For instance, the case that you gave me was you go to the lake and you're relaxing, you're on vacation and you're studying, but you don't do any work that day. So I gave you an introduction last week where I mentioned the rebellion of Korach. And I said Korach was a man who he came before Moses, and he stated that there's a law of mezuzah, but nevertheless, it's only to remind you of the central ideas of Torah, which is the existence of God, his oneness, love of God, and study of Torah, keeping of the mitzvahs. So those ideas are all contained in that scroll. Now, Korach said, if you have your house filled with the five books, the entire Torah, many Torahs, as a matter of fact, there wouldn't be any need to have this reminder on the doorpost. And I explained that Korach's concept was, Korach did not deny the giving of the Torah at Sinai. He couldn't. Everybody witnessed it. And he couldn't deny that Moses was the one that God spoke to. But what he did do was come up with a different interpretation. His interpretation was that God is interested in the mitzvos philosophically, but not halachically. In other words, God does not care about the details of how you carry out each mitzvah. What he is concerned with is that you should be in line with the philosophical ideas of the mitzvos. So if the concept is to remind you of the main ideas of the Torah, and your house is filled with Torahs, then you don't need a mezuzah on the door. Whereas Moses said, no, that's not true. God is very meticulous in the sense that he wants you to keep the mitzvah exactly the way it is, through a mezuzah. You can't use any other means. So it doesn't matter if your house is filled with holy Torahs, but the fact is you need that mezuzah on the door. That's what Moses said. And then, as you know in the story, what took place in order to demonstrate that Moses was in line with the God, and that was that the earth swallowed up those people, and that was a demonstration from then on and forever that the Torah was given with the concept of halacha and not just philosophy. So getting back to the to our situation here with the Ben Noach, we explained according to Rashi that the Torah does not believe that it is good for a person to take
over. Rabbi,
yes,
we have a question from Mr. John Miller.
Go right ahead. Okay, go ahead.
Rabbi Tate, in reference to a mezuzah, mm-hmm. What is the ruling for B'nai Noach? Is it permissible to place one, or is it an open decision per se that says yay or nay?
Okay. That's a good question. I could tell you, from a practical standpoint, let me just tell you what it is. It's not that simple. According to Maimonides, as I said last week, that a Ben Noach can fulfill any positive commandment. And that would mean that the Ben Noach can put on tefillin, the Ben Noach can have a mezuzah on his door, could do any commandment in the Torah. There was, however, several hundred years ago, the custom was created among the authorities that they did not permit Bnei Noach to do such things, like such to keep mitzvahs which had scrolls that were sacred, because they were concerned that the Bnei Noach would not really take proper care of those articles. Like tefillin, they have to be treated in a special way. You can't just, as a matter of fact, tefillin must be rolled up. You can't just leave them hanging around the house. And it could be a matter of experience at that time with the particular Bnei Noach that they had, that they weren't careful with these type of objects. So therefore, they determined not to encourage Bnei Noach to keep those mitzvos which have to do with sacred articles. But if you ask me, that's something that one of the authorities mentions, a later authority. But from the halacha itself, in other words, essentially, if a Ben Noach is permitted to do it, and if he does, he fulfills the mitzvah of the Torah. Now, I don't want to render any kind of decision contrary to the decision rendered before, but I would simply say that basically, Ben Noach is permitted to keep any mitzvah of the Torah. And if he does, he is rewarded for it. But as I said, the rabbis, certain rabbis, did not encourage it because they were afraid that the Ben Noach, you might have, for instance, a father that is a Ben Noach, but then his children aren't, and around the house he's going to have a pair of phylacteries, and then they won't be treated properly. They place it on the floor or not take care of it, or leave it around, just hanging around, not wrapped up properly. So therefore they did not encourage the Bnei Noach to do that. That's basically what it is. Okay? Did I answer your question?
Yes, that was an adequate answer, or a good answer. Not adequate, it was a good answer. Okay, here is Martina Buchanan.
Okay, my question is, if, say, we're building a house and we put it on our doorpost, okay, what happens if we keep the laws that we keep and we want to do it on the intention, good intentions of doing this because we wanted to do a mitzvah, but we sell our house? Do we take this off? Or do the people who move in, if we leave it on it, what if they don't believe anything that we believe?
Right, then you have to take it off. That's the same. You would have the same problem that a Ben Israel has when selling his house. Now, the law is like this. If a Ben Israel sells his house to another Ben Israel, so then he's not permitted to take off the mezuzah because he's supposed to leave it for the next person and not let it take off. The family that moves in should really pay reimburse the former owner for, because they're expensive. I mean, nowadays a good mezuzah could run you, last time I took a look at it, was about $26. I understand it's even higher now, a good one. But, and that's just for one, so you can imagine an entire house could be hundreds of dollars. But technically speaking, the one who leaves is supposed to leave it on the doors. You're not supposed to take it off. One of the reasons is you're not supposed to destroy an article of mitzvah. It's a type of destruction when you separate the mitzvah from the house, because it's like one. It's viewed halachically like one entity. But if a non-Jew is going to move in, you're supposed to remove the mezuzah because, as I said before, it might not be treated properly, and that wouldn't be correct. So therefore, the Ben Noach has the same exact kind of situation as the Ben Israel in that respect. It depends who's moving in. If there's any chance that it's not going to be treated with respect, there's neither the person that's moving in doesn't know anything about it, and liable to discard it, just throw it in the garbage, or not watch it properly, then you must remove it. You're not permitted to leave it unless the person that's moving in knows the mitzvah of mezuzah and keeps the mitzvah of mezuzah and is careful with the mezuzah. Okay?
Okay. All right. We got another question here.
Okay.
We're on a roll tonight.
Okay.
It's John Miller.
Rabbi. Mm-hmm. This John again.
Yes, John.
Could you step us through the process and explain the attachment of the mezuzah, are there any special blessings that have to be said? It's high in elevation. The particulars that we would have to be aware of, to kind of give us a little commonality in case some of us would like to fulfill this mitzvah?
Well, I would have to really, I'll tell you, I could do it, the only way I could do this is at the conference, because there is no mitzvah that doesn't have a lot of details, and you have to know exactly where to put it on the door, and how to put it on the door, how to roll the scroll, and blessings in general, I think you should just know one principle about it's an important principle because it has to do with what we've been speaking about all along. No blessing, and the blessings in the Torah, I'm sorry, the blessings that a person makes never prevent one from doing the mitzvah. What I mean, never prevent, I mean, if a person does not make a blessing, it does not nullify the mitzvah. Let me put it that way. Okay? Blessings are dispensable. That's a general rule, which means to say if the person did not make the blessing, it has nothing to do with whether you fulfill the mitzvah. There is a blessing for putting on a mezuzah on the door, but that is a separate commandment. No, a separate mitzvah. That's a rabbinical injunction. So if a person didn't make the blessing, it does not nullify his mezuzah. It's fine. That same thing with all the blessings. If a person, for instance, put on phylacteries and he did not make the blessing, he fulfills the mitzvah regardless. The blessing is an additional thing. It has nothing to do with the structure of the mitzvah itself. Okay, in a general way. I mean, there are specific exceptions where, you know, to this, but generally speaking, it's something you should know, that a blessing is never a part of the mitzvah. I say this because people have such a misconception about blessings in Judaism, like people think, you know, the rabbi blesses the food, or you bless the cow before they slaughter it. It's like a total misconception, and it's really taking Christian ideas and trying to apply it to Judaism. But in the Judaic law, a blessing is always a separate entity outside of the mitzvah. It's related to the mitzvah, but if you don't do it, it doesn't nullify. It has nothing to do with the nullification or fulfillment, the actualization of the mitzvah. Okay, so there is a blessing, though, that could be said by a Ben Oaf. Ben Oaf could say the blessing, but the mitzvah of the Torah has nothing to do with the blessing. The mitzvah of the Torah is simply placing it on the door in the proper way. It has to be the proper scroll. It should be rolled a certain way. I have to demonstrate that, and I have to show you exactly where to place it on the door. Okay, I have to measure it off. It has to be placed in a certain position at a certain height on the door. Okay? So I could do that when I come down, but it's difficult to do it over the phone. Now, getting back to the, are there any more questions?
I think we're in good shape right now. We go back to our main topic.
Okay, so getting back to the topic of the Ben Noach at the camp, when they're relaxing and not doing work according to Rashi. Now, I explained the concept of Rashi's concept, and that is, according to Rashi, the Torah maintains that, not like, I heard somebody say, what did the president do on his vacation? So, the word was that he was vegging out. The Torah does not look at that as very kindly. There's, what a person, a human being should always be doing something productive every day. And, if a person is not productive, it's a wasted day. For the Ben Israel, as I said, the Ben Israel has mitzvos from the time he opens his eyes until he goes to sleep. The Ben Noach can do mitzvos, but he's not obligated to do mitzvos. Therefore, according to Rashi, the Ben Noach must be productive in a different way. And that productivity is to be part of the process of helping society and civilization, which means doing something constructive. Okay, that's some kind of work. And this is not something which is looked down upon, by the way. The Torah does not look down upon work. That concept of looking down upon work, from what I read, really came from the pagan priests, because they were the ones that felt that the priesthood did not do any work, and therefore they were maintained, and work was looked down upon. The Torah looks up at a person that does work. As a matter of fact, the Talmud states work is a great thing because the rabbis worked And work is a great thing because it gives honor, the Talmud says, to the one who does it. And the Talmud states that Jacob, for instance, when he came to Shechem, so he said at that time, he says, I want to be involved in, it's called helping society, maintaining tikkun olam in Hebrew. It means helping society, doing something for civilization. And that's why he bought a piece of field from the people of Shechem, and that was, he wanted to partake in society and doing business and being helpful to and productive in society. So that was something which our forefather, the patriarch Jacob, did, and it's something which is considered very good for everyone, and not just the Ben Noach. But since the Ben Noach doesn't have any obligations from morning to night, so therefore his expression of being productive should be in terms of some kind of productive activity. But now your question to me was, well, what about the Ben Noach if he's studying Torah? So why should he have to be productive according to Rashi? And that's why I gave you this whole lengthy introduction. The reason is because I wanted to demonstrate to you that once a halacha is formed, in other words, once God gives a certain form of expression to an idea, we cannot deviate and say, well, we will create our own form of expression for the idea. For instance, you know very well that there's a mitzvah to eat matzah on the night of Passover, because to commemorate the Exodus and when they ate matzah when they left Egypt. Now, let's say a person will have a different way of commemorating that. He'll show a video of going out of Egypt. That would not do, because God gave the mitzvah a specific form, and that was the argument between Moses and Korach, and Moses said, no, you must have the specific mitzvah, exactly the way it is formulated. So too for the Ben Noach, even though a particular Ben Noach may study Torah, but you have to realize this is something which is an optional activity for him. And according to Rashi, there was a specific formula by God which states that the Ben Noach, he must be productive every day, and it was given a specific form. Now, you can understand very well why that form was given, because the Ben Israel has the obligation constantly to do all the mitzvot, whereas the Ben Noach doesn't. Now, let's say you have a particular Ben Noach who is really studying Torah. So philosophically, you'd be correct. Philosophically, he wouldn't have to do anything. But then we have the halacha, and the halacha is very specific. Now, since God gave a specific form to this concept, which means to demonstrate that a person must be productive each day, so therefore the Ben Noach must do some kind of work during that day, so it doesn't matter if the person is really studying Torah. That's very nice philosophically, but then we have to deal again with the halachic concept, and that is to keep the commandment according to the specific form that God gave it, not just according to the philosophical idea. That was Korach's concept, but we don't hold by that. So therefore, we hold by Moses, and therefore you must follow God's formula. So according, what I would say is that if a Ben Noach, and this would certainly be extremely virtuous, if a Ben Noach, in the case of, where you're at the camp, I would say this much. I say that David Davis doesn't have to do anything because that is his work. His work is to teach, and that's for him. That's his job. That's his work. So he's fulfilling his productivity, his obligation. But the other people that are present, according to Rashi, should do at least something. In other words, they shouldn't allow the day to go by without doing anything. He could do some kind of constructive activity, could mow the lawn, do some kind of activity that is productive around the house or in some way to demonstrate the concept that the Torah holds that a human being should be productive every day and should not take even one day of his life off just to lounge around and to, veg out.
Okay, I'm sorry. Rabbi.
Yes.
I've got a question for you, and J. David's got me all upset here. You say that God gave the formula for the B'nai Noah to work every day.
Right.
Where did he give this formula at? Is it in Torah? Is it in...
Okay, the, That's what I was explaining to you, that it's an argument between Maimonides and most of the scholars and the scholar Rashi. According to the way Rashi interprets the oral law on the verse that day and night shall not rest, in Hebrew it's interpreted day and night. If you look at the grammar there, it says they shall not rest. So there's an implication, according to Rashi, this is where Rashi interprets the oral law, to mean that Ben Noach should not rest for a complete day where he does absolutely nothing for 24 hours. That's Rashi's interpretation. Now, as I mentioned before, Rashi is the only one that interprets it that way. So I say Ben Noach is not obligated to follow Rashi, since most of the other scholars interpret it differently. But if a Ben Noach wants to be extra virtuous, it would not be a crazy thing. It would be if he took upon himself to fulfill even Rashi's position, because his position, Rashi was a great scholar, and there is no real, since we don't have a Sanhedrin anymore, there's no way to come, we can't come to a real definite exclusion of Rashi's position. So, therefore, my answer is as follows, that you aren't obligated to follow Rashi's position, but if you did want to do it, that would be considered an extra virtuous activity. And the way to do that would be to make sure that you did some kind of constructive action during that day in order to demonstrate the concept that man should not just take a day out of his life where he does nothing, that this is not really proper for man to, it's not a proper philosophy. It's a philosophy that leads man away from the correct path and not towards the correct path. So it doesn't mean he has to work for 8 hours. It doesn't even mean he has to work for 1 hour. But it would be a halachic thing that he should do some kind of activity that is constructive during that day, some physical kind of activity that's constructive during that day. He could fix his car, he could do, you know, anything which is constructive. That would be, then he would fulfill Rashi's position. So again, let me make it clear. You don't have to fulfill Rashi's position, but if a person wanted to, that would be considered beyond, so to speak, what is required, but nevertheless, not something which is meaningless. It would have a meaning for the Ben Noach, and it would be considered a fulfillment for him. Okay? So it's an optional kind of a thing. But Rashi's concept, I want you to understand that Rashi's concept, even though most do not agree with the way Rashi interprets the oral law in this case, but the concept is definitely a valid one. It's definitely, in other words, everybody agrees with it, with the philosophy of it, that the purpose of...
Rabbi Chait?
Yes.
What verse was that where you quoted in they?
Okay, hold on.
In the Torah?
Let me get my verse. The verse is in Genesis. It is Genesis 8, verse 22. Okay? And, Sanhedrin. I'll show you how Rashi interprets it. Now, I have to explain something to you. And this is, I've been trying to explain this a number of times, but I know it's very difficult. But I'm going to do it again. And that is that according to Torah, a person who does not know the methods of the oral law cannot just take a look at a verse and just say, this is what I think it means, this is what I think it doesn't mean. You have to, there's a certain amount of subordination here to the scholars of the Talmud. When a person's a scholar, he can't do that. But if they're not a scholar, their interpretation is not based on anything. It's just the way they feel that they're interpreting the law. But that's not correct. You have to go by the scholars. So I could tell you that I cannot argue on Rashi, and neither can you. This is his opinion. You can't look at that verse and just say, well, I don't think that's what the verse is talking about, because there's a system of the oral law which is a little different. It operates in its own orbit, so to speak. You have to become familiar with that. But that is Rashi's position. It's based on that verse, and I'll tell you exactly what Rashi says if you just give me a minute. Just a second. Yeah. Right. Right. Rashi explains that the, you see, when it says, the verse says, shall not rest. Now, at the end of the verse, do you ever have it? It says, it's speaking about the seasons over there. The open verse is speaking about the seasons. And it says that all the seasons shall not cease. I don't know what your translation is. But in Hebrew, the word is lo yishbosu. And lo yishbosu, Rashi says that the Talmud, according to Rashi, is stating that, and this, by the way, the fact that what Rashi is saying, this is the verse, no one disagrees with that. Even Maimonides agrees that that's the verse. The only question is what the verse is referring to. Is it referring to the fact that a Ben Noach can't take a day off, or it means that a Ben Noach can't create a holiday? That's the only question. But the Talmud is on, if a person wants to look it up, it's in Sanhedrin, and it's 58b, okay? And Rashi explains that it means that they should not, that they're not permitted to, that the Ben Noach is not permitted to take off a day, a complete day, from his productive activities, okay? Now, again, this is the Talmudic interpretation of the verse because of the Hebrew phrase lo yishbosu, which means Shabbos, which Shabbos, he recognized, means a day of rest. So therefore, the Talmud explains that the term lo yishbosu is a double entendre. It means the seasons won't cease, but it also is an allusion to the halacha that a ben noach cannot keep the Shabbos. And you have to understand that, you see, I have to get more into explaining to the oral law how it works. It does not mean to say that the Talmud went through this verse, you know, and just said that this is what the verse means. The oral law is carried down from Sinai as a law separate, as a factual law separate from the verse. But it was, there's always an allusion to every law in the Torah. And this is the allusion from the double entendre, from the use of a form of the word that has to do with Shabbos. So that's the way it works. That's why I say it's a different kind of system. You can't just, there is the overt Bible, and then there is the covert. In other words, there is the allusions in the Torah for the oral system. But the oral system wasn't derived. In other words, a group of rabbis didn't sit down and just say, well, let's take a look at this verse. This is what it means. The oral system was carried down from Sinai, but it always is hooked in somehow. There's always a connection or an allusion to it from the Torah itself. That is the allusion for it. It's not a derivation. There's a difference between a derivation and an allusion. So therefore, I understand farewell that anyone that looks at your translation, you're going to say, well, what if this has nothing to do with it? This is referring to the seasons. But that's because you're not familiar with the oral law itself and how it works. But I'm just trying to point out one thing to you, and that is it is not a derivation. Maimonides points this out, if you're interested further. Maimonides points this out in his introduction to the Mishnah. And if you get a hold of that, it's in English, too, by the way. It has been translated. If you get a hold of that, you'll see. For instance, Talmud discusses what is an esrog. You know, we use that. Those are the four species. So what is a citron? And the Talmud asks, how do we know what it is? And Maimonides explains that they weren't asking how we know what it is because everybody had it last year and the year before and the year before. They didn't just sit down and try to discover this. This was something which was done for centuries. But he explains that everything that we do has to have some kind of an allusion to it in the text of the Torah itself, and that's why there's all these Talmudical statements showing the allusion. So you have to realize that it doesn't mean it's derived from this verse.
But you may proceed.
Okay. So, again, the only argument is between Rashi and Maimonides and the Rambam. The argument is whether that means that the Ben Noach cannot take off a day, in other words, have a day in which he is taking a vacation, or it means he is not permitted to establish a holiday of Shabbos. But the fact that that verse is an allusion to the oral law is agreed upon by all. That's not even argued among the scholars of the Talmud. I mean, among the rabbinical scholars, such as Rashi and the Rambam. It is an argument as to what the violation is for the Ben Noach. So therefore, as I said again, if a Ben Noach wants to be extra cautious and wants to fulfill even Rashi's interpretation, it is quite simple for him to do so. All he'd have to do is do a specific activity, productive activity. It doesn't give any amount of time. It just says that a day shouldn't pass where he's completely unproductive, and the reason obviously is to teach the world a philosophy that it is not a good idea for a human being to just let a day just waste away. That's something that leads towards a disintegration of society, not towards the building of society. Okay, it's a little different than our American value system, but that's the Torah value system. Any questions on this point?
I think we're in pretty good shape, and you may proceed.
Okay, I'm glad that in passing we were able to discuss a little bit about the system of the oral law and about the concept of halacha, which is something which I don't think 99% of the people in the world have any idea of what it is. That is extremely important for Ben Noach to know, the concept of halacha, that halacha is not just philosophy, it's much more than philosophy. And the halacha has a specific structure, and we're obligated to keep the formula that God gave us. And part of the concept of that formula is, again, has to do with what we spoke about last week, and that is that there is no such thing as taboo in the Torah. And there's no such thing as that's why of course, I mean, goes without saying, there's no such thing as amulets or any kind of magical objects. The mezuzah has concepts, ideas, and there's no magical omens or anything like that in the whole Torah system. That's all this type of thing, this type of thinking, taboo and omens and superstition. There's no room for that in halacha. And we don't have any such thing. There's no such thing. The Torah is outright against it. And you have to realize, like some people say, what is the purpose of this? Why is everything so specific and have such a specific form? And the reason is, we could ask again. I mean, the Torah does not permit man to create a god that he wants. The Torah demands that man subordinate himself to God. And we could ask the same question about why God structured the atom in a certain way, a very specific way. And man, through centuries and centuries, first starts approaching and uncovering the specific formula, the mathematical formula that can describe the phenomena of the atom and the physical world, the world of nature, the laws of nature. But the laws of nature are very exact and precise, and so are the laws of the Torah, the oral laws, the written laws. They are a precise formula. Now, why God works that way? One reason why God works that way is because God always works with knowledge and with wisdom. And knowledge dictates that if you change one iota in a formula, that's not the same formula anymore. Knowledge demands exactitude, and the halacha demands exactitude. It has to be a very specific way. If you change one iota of that formula, you don't have the formula anymore, and the whole beauty of the structure is lost. The halacha is very, the structures of halacha have a logical beauty to them. I was reading recently a book by the Nobel Prize winner Steven Weinberg, and he writes about physics, and he writes about how when one reaches the higher levels of the study of physics, one becomes imbued with the realization of the beauty of the laws of the universe. And every physicist knows that there's a certain intuition, a kind of appreciation, an aesthetic appreciation of ideas that guides him in his study of nature and pursuing his his approaches, his guesses, so to speak, his hunches, and understanding and uncovering nature. And the same thing exists, the exact same. This idea, which Steve Weinberg talks about, he speaks about it as a relatively recent idea in the world of physics. He's not aware of the fact that this idea we've had in Talmud for thousands of years. And that's what King David speaks about when he says that your laws are like music to me. And how beautiful, how great are their works, oh God, everything is done with wisdom. And where he speaks about how sweet the laws of the Torah are. What he means is this aesthetic appreciation for the beauty of the ideas of the Torah. And every law is formulated in a very specific way. When you study it, when a person really becomes educated and comes into the higher sphere of learning, one sees an unbelievable beauty in the formulation of these halachos, of these laws. Just like a person who reaches the higher echelons, the higher levels of physics, sees beauty in the formula of the physical world. So God works the same way in Torah as he does in his physical world as well. That everything is formulated precisely and with a certain aesthetic, intellectual beauty. And man has a divine element in his soul which can appreciate that. Now, of course, a person who is not learned, he doesn't grasp this because he's never seen it. It has no meaning to him because he's simply ignorant. Just like a person who doesn't know physics is only interested in putting on his television, so it's a relatively easy action. But he doesn't appreciate the knowledge and the understanding that lies behind that. The understanding of the laws of nature that was necessary to harness this type of an object. So the average person has no concept of this. That doesn't mean that his world is correct. His world is not the correct world. The correct world is the one that a person reaches through knowledge and through understanding. The same thing is true of Talmud. People do not. That's why people thought. The ignorant people thought that the oral law and the rabbis, the doctors of the Talmud, were legalists. That's one of the things in the New Testament where they criticized the Pharisees. But they simply did not understand. They weren't learned and didn't understand what the Pharisees were saying. Pharisees were saying that there is an unbelievable system of knowledge here and beauty, and it's not legalism. It would be just like saying the world of physics is very structured and very legal. Yes, it's true, but it's very beautiful because you can't have beauty if the thing you have is amorphous, if it has no form. And the same thing is true with halacha. As a matter of fact, that's one of the reasons why we have to study Torah is that one of the prime movers that makes us keep the Torah and draws us to the Torah is this beauty of the laws of God. And when you see it and you appreciate it, you're drawn to it like a magnet. That's why the Torah emphasizes again and again the importance of study and of knowledge. And that's why throughout the history of the people of Israel, the scholars were, from the time of Moses, the scholar is always the central figure, the central Torah figure. And throughout the centuries, the ones that made the decisions in the Talmudic law, which was the whole essence of what today is the Orthodox system of Torah, was always done by all these decisions were always made by the scholars of Israel. And it's very technical. There's no question about it. It's technical. But the technicality is, again, an intrinsic and integral part of the system, because that's where the beauty of the understanding of the system lies. Without the technical structure, without the precise formula, there is no beauty to the Torah. The beauty of the Torah emerges from the halacha and from the specific formula. Now, some of these things may sound very strange to people, but again, it's strange to a person that doesn't study, just like the laws of physics are strange to a person that doesn't study. I give you an example. See, That's how halachic decisions are rendered. I'll give you an example. For instance, the law of the menses. Okay, that a woman when she's menstruating cannot live at that time with her husband, with anyone actually. So this is found in Leviticus 15:19. Okay, if you have a Bible, you can check it out. 15:19. So this is discussing. Well, actually, this is discussing. There's two aspects of this. One is that she is tamei, which is with regard to the mikdash, with regard to the temple, and then also that she's not permitted to live, to have sexual intercourse during that time. The verse that I gave you is mentioned with regard to the temple, but it's the exact same phenomenon. The one with regard to sexual intercourse is 18:19, okay? 18:19. But it's the same phenomenon. The reason why I referred you to the first text, I'll show you in a moment. But the text states that, I don't know which translation you're using, but basically I'll try to do it as close as I can to the text. It says, if blood will be oozing from a woman, which is referring to the menstruation, so it says, the blood will be oozing from her flesh, in her flesh, actually. I don't know what your translation is. I'm referring to Leviticus 15:19. Okay, then it says, for 7 days she should be in this state of nida. I can't translate. I don't know what translation she is. I have to think about it. I think it would be a proper translation. But at any rate, what I want to point out is the phrase before, where it says that the blood will be oozing in her flesh. And the question, of course, is why does the Torah have to give that kind of a description? It already stated in the previous phrase, made it quite clear that it's referring to the process, natural process of menstruation. Actually, it's a little more than menstruation. It could be, it's menstruation, Rabbi Soloveitchik used to say, it's menstruation plus, because it doesn't have to really be menstruation. But let me get back to this point where I mentioned the phrase, the specific phrase, where it says that the blood is oozing in her flesh. And the Talmud, the oral law, says that this means that the way a woman comes into that state is only if there is contact between the blood and her flesh. So that would mean, of course, that if a tube were inserted, in which case the blood would, let's say a plastic tube was inserted, and the blood would not make contact. It would go directly from the uterus outside of her body. She would not become a nida. Okay, now this is pretty much in the text. You don't even really need to have the knowledge of the oral law on this, because it's pretty much, if you just translate the phrase, you'll see it's pretty obvious that's what it means. But of course, we, as I said, all our interpretations are based on the oral system, and this is what the oral law states. Now, that's the way it has to be. It's technical, but this is the definition, part of the picture of what a woman that is in this state in which there can't be any sexual intercourse during those 7 days. And also with regard to the temple, there are certain laws with regard to the temple. That state is, that's part of the description of the state. Now, of course, you have to really understand the whole, there's a whole tractate just on this. So I can't possibly expect you to understand the whole formula for this. But what I would like to just point out is that and this is important, because people will say, well, what difference does that make? That sounds ridiculous. What difference does it make if she's menstruating? If she's in the state of menstruation, what do I care? If I insert a plastic tube and it goes to the uterus, now she's not going to be, now she can actually have intercourse. I mean, it just sounds strange. But in this lies the secret of the entire concept of Torah. And that goes back to what we spoke about last week, and that is that the Torah is not taboo. And that is the most important concept, I think, for a person to know. If you take a course in comparative religion, which I don't recommend, because the people may know other religions, but they have no concept of Torah, and they try to lump Torah together with other religions. And they will say, well, menstrual taboos are found in all kinds of primitive societies. That is correct, but it's not found, and they will say that that's why the Torah also has it. That is incorrect. The Torah does not have any menstrual taboo. As I mentioned last week, Yalta, the wife of the great scholar Rav Nachman, mentioned to him that everything that is prohibited, there is also a similar thing, or different under different conditions, it's permissible. And that's precisely to remove a person from any kind of taboo system. That's why you have the whole intricate system of halacha. Halacha is a logical system. It's not a taboo system. If it were a taboo, it wouldn't make any difference. In the taboo society, the menstruating woman must be kept away from. In a Torah society, the definition is a precise technical formula. So you could have two women that are menstruating. One is considered in the state of menstruation and one in the prohibited state, and one is not considered in the prohibited state. As I mentioned last week, the case that Yalta gave was the case from the beginning of what we call Tazria, but I'll give it to you. It's Leviticus 12. 12, if you read through Leviticus 12, 4 and 5, where there is the blood that's the clean blood, which means to say that if she menstruates during that period, that during after 7 days, the 33 days for a boy, and the 66 days for a if she gives birth to a girl, so then she has double the amount of days, 66 days in which any blood that she sees does not render her in the prohibited state. So there again, she could be menstruating, but she's not prohibited. And the reason is because the Torah never wanted a person to be attached to any kind of taboo emotion, but rather to be attached to a system, a logical system, which has great intellectual beauty, so that again, that's the Torah's idea of raising a person from the primitive to the intellectual sphere. As we mentioned with the idea of kosher, the Torah says you should differentiate between the clean animal and the unclean animal, and to teach the children of Israel. It's a process of learning and of study. It's not a process of taboo. Other religions and primitive societies may have menstrual taboos. The Torah has no such thing. Now, you'll say, well, why did the Torah choose something which in primitive societies there is something similar, with namely a menstrual taboo? This I would give two possible reasons for. One reason is, I would say, is because simply the Torah doesn't have to be concerned with what other societies do. The Torah is a system that stands on its own, which means to say, since God wanted people to practice, I don't want to use self-control, because again, it's more than self-control. Self-control is one emotion against another, whereas this is an attraction to the rational element in man, the soul, that the soul should have supremacy over the instincts. So the Torah wanted to choose a situation in which husband and wife, who can always, under ordinary circumstances, have intercourse, yet the Torah wanted them to have this instinct under control, that there should be a time when they should exercise their judgment against having intercourse. So the Torah chose a very simple thing, that a woman has this biological clock, and it used the biological clock to, it's a very practical thing, to set up, in general, a way in which the person would have to exercise control over his instinct. So that's a very simple and straightforward answer. I would even give another possibility, and this would be based on Maimonides' approach in general in his guide. When Maimonides shows that the Torah wanted to remove people from certain primitive emotions that were prevalent at the time, that the people themselves may have had, and the Torah was very careful to take those primitive drives and give them a different kind of objective. And that's why the Ryan, as you're familiar, the Maimonides states that was the idea of sacrifice also, that the people had a primitive idea of sacrifice, and the Torah took that primitive notion. It couldn't stop them from doing that completely, but what it did was it gave this drive a totally different kind of framework, so that it didn't allow them, for instance, the worst thing would be to sacrifice outside of the temple, because then they can get lost in their own fantasies. They can only sacrifice in the temple. In the temple, you had the scholars. The Sanhedrin was in the temple. The priests who were knowledgeable of the halacha. So therefore, this primitive emotion was converted into a higher intellectual experience. And the same thing, I would say, is possible in the case of the menstruation. All those societies had primitive menstrual taboos. The Torah made a halacha out of it. It made a whole science out of the a whole system of knowledge out of this prohibited state. And therefore, it took the people away from the primitive taboo system to a system, an intellectual system of Torah study and the oral law. And this, and through that means, the nation of Israel was raised to a higher level and removed from the type of societies that surrounded them, the notions and the ideas of the primitive societies that surrounded them. So I would give those two answers. But the important thing to remember is that there is no correspondence. There is no commonality between menstrual taboos and what the Torah calls nida in Hebrew. Nida is a different formula completely. It doesn't have to be menstruation; it could be outside of menstruation, and the woman could be menstruating, and it could not be a nida. It's a very specific formula. There's another thing they have to realize that results from this. That the fact that the halacha is very technical also has a great benefit for mankind, because while it serves to, on the whole, to cause man to exercise the supremacy of his mind over his instincts, which is the Torah ideal, under certain situations it also allows certain permits to take place. For instance, there was a case in Israel where a woman discovered that when she went to the mikveh, that's after the period of time, after the state of nida, the prohibited state, the menstrual state, and then she immersed herself in the mikveh, and then she is permitted to have intercourse with her husband. Now, it was discovered that in this woman the cycle was very short, and therefore she was unable to conceive in other words, at the time when she became permissible, it was too late already for conception to take place. Now, there was one great scholar in Israel that made the suggestion that she should use a plastic tube which would prevent her from coming into that state, and therefore she would be able to have intercourse during the time it's appropriate for her, and she would be able to have a child. Now, there was a whole big discussion about this. I'm not going to get you involved in what happened. I just want you to be aware of the concept of the idea. What I'm trying to point out to you is that since the halacha is very technical, the technicality serves a practical purpose too, and that is, the amazing thing is that with all the abundance of halacha, the way the formulas are so specific allows man to, at certain times when necessary, to be able to find, it's not a loophole. I don't want to use the word loophole, because loophole is wrong. Loophole would mean that you're trying to avoid the law. It's not an avoidance of the law. This is exactly what God wants you to do. He wants you to be aware of the formula, have knowledge of the formula. He doesn't want the thing to be prohibited. Let me just go back again to the story of Yalta, when she came to her husband, the great scholar of Nachman, and she said, you know very well the principle of Torah. She was a very learned woman, that whatever the Torah prohibits, there's always something that's permissible. And she said to him, I want to eat meat and milk. And how is that permissible? How can I do that? And he told her how she could do it. As I mentioned last week, that was taking the udder and cooking the udder with the milk in it. Now, the question, of course, is that we should ask is, this is a very strange story. Was she crazy? I mean, she had to have the meat and milk. Doesn't say she was pregnant or she had some kind of crazy urge. The Talmud just says she just came one day to her husband and she wanted to eat the meat and milk, and he helped her. He didn't say, well, why, that's ridiculous. Why do you want to do this? In my opinion, the reason why, what she was saying to him was, on the contrary, that you see, the Torah does not want a taboo system. What the Torah wants, God doesn't want you to suffer. I'm speaking, let's say, to Ben Israel, to suffer the abstention of pork. No, that's not what God wants. God wants the Ben Israel to enjoy the supremacy of his mind over his emotions, over his instincts. So therefore, if that's the case, so if there is something which is permissible that tastes exactly like pork, or there are certain instances where pork is permissible, it's perfectly right and wonderful for the person to eat it. God does not want restrictions. God wants a certain state of mind where there's a supremacy and a control over the instinctual life of man. That is what man is. That makes him that gives him his essence. That's really the divine part of him functioning. So therefore, if that's the case, it's not that God wants the Ben Israel not to eat meat and milk. No, that's not true. What he wants is a certain kind of supremacy of the mind over the emotions. So therefore, she said on the contrary, she wishes to eat the meat and the milk to demonstrate that it's not a taboo kind of thing and to experience it herself. There's nothing wrong with it.
Rabbi, you got 60 seconds.
Okay. But there's nothing wrong with eating it. It's the differentiation which is important. So therefore, eating it and abstaining from it is the exact same thing. Eating it in one instance where it's permissible, because you have to use your mind to differentiate that this is permissible, and abstaining when the differentiation tells you must abstain. But there is no virtue in the abstention itself. That's the point I want to make. And that is really the entire system of halacha. And that's what is different about halacha. That's why the Talmud says a person shouldn't say, I dislike pork. It's not that you dislike pork. It is that the Torah prohibits it under certain circumstances. As I mentioned last week, under other circumstances, it's permissible. So that's the basic concept, and I think it's an important one. Because it really gives the whole philosophy, the whole unique philosophy of Torah. What is the Torah's philosophy? Is seeking perfection in man. It's not seeking restrictions and prohibitions. Okay, I'll stop there.
Okay, that was good.